and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-completed elections in Afghanistan that are being hailed as a success by Afghan and Western leaders. We'll look into the apparent gulf between the people's aspiration for governance and the realities of a government beset by systemic corruption, crippled by capital flight from the elite, and a countryside controlled by either the Taliban or fiefdoms run by warlords. A decades-long researcher of Afghanistan's culture and politics, Thomas Barfield, the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, professor of anthropology at Boston University and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History, joins us to discuss whether democracy is taking root in this war-torn, economically dependent country that has been the battleground for America's longest war. Then we'll get an assessment of the success of the Affordable Care Act sign-up of 7.1 million Americans that the White House is celebrating and examine its effect on the upcoming election, which so far is muted, with the Republicans who have been ritually denouncing Obamacare being curiously silent and Democrats who have been tepidly supporting it apparently ambivalent. Cheryl Kaminsky, a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, joins us to evaluate the ACA's impact on health care reform. Then finally, Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population and Development Program at Cornell University, joins us to discuss his much-anticipated new book, just out, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes, which looks into the darker side of the land of opportunity, analyzing 41 years of data that finds a majority of Americans will experience poverty despite the American dream's promise of a good life that is attainable through hard work and perseverance. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He is also president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and is co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And the elections that took place on Saturday in Afghanistan are being hailed by both Afghan and Western leaders as a success. I think there was about 20 people killed, and a number of Taliban were also killed. And the weather was very poor, but apparently there was a record turnout, I think more than twice that turned out in the last election, of course, that were heavily marred by a fairly brazen rigging. Is that your understanding?
Yes, there seemed to have been much more excitement on this. Of course, this is the first election that Afghanistan has ever had without an incumbent, and that whoever wins, it promises to change the administration. So it's bound to generate some excitement.
But we won't know the results probably for a while. And then if one of the three candidates doesn't make it to 50%, there will be a runoff in May, right?
Yes, because while there are three front runners, there are many more candidates, so the likelihood of anybody getting a majority in this round are pretty slim, so we can expect to see a runoff, I believe.
So, Thomas Barfield, you have Ashraf Ghani, who American-educated. He's from the Pashtun tribe. His running mate is Abdul Rashid Dostum, the leader of the Uzbek group. Ghani, of course, was the finance minister under Karzai. The other front-runner who ran last time is Dr. Abdullah, who's with the Tajiks, although I believe either his mother or father was a Pashtun. He is partnered with Mohammad Mohadek, who is a leader of the Hazara ethnic group near the Iranian border in that area. He also has a Pashtun on the ticket who's affiliated with a splinter group of the Taliban. And then you have Zalmay Rasool, who's pretty much the establishment candidate. He's a Karzai ally and former foreign minister as well, backed by the president's brother. From your reading of it, of the tea leaves, who do you think is going to come out ahead?
Well, I do think Abdullah will be in the runoff, and I think right now probably the fiercest fight is between Rasool, who was Karzai's sort of hand-picked nominee, although he refused to endorse anybody. Karzai forced his brother out of the race, and his brother threw his support to Rasool. That happened on a couple of other minor candidates that way. But it's also true that Karzai has, it may not be his first choice, but also has backed Ghani to some extent. The interesting thing here is that from the point of view of, with the exception of Abdullah, whose father is a Pashtun but is perceived to be allied with the Tajiks, all the other candidates running for president are sort of splitting the Pashtun votes. So it's a problem. How do you get to the second round? And actually having Dostum as his vice president is not helping him with his Pashtun constituencies, because Ghani has sort of run as a champion of the Pashtuns at some place, but taking on a warlord who's has a fairly tough record against the Pashtuns in the civil war has made his life a little bit difficult.
And the establishment candidate Rasul, his running mate is a woman, right? Habiba Sarabi.
Yes, that's a first for Afghanistan.
So and of course the Taliban largely come from the Pashtuns. So
yes, but so does the ruling dynasty. So they right. make up, if not a majority, a plurality of Afghans. So it's not surprising that they come in all sizes and flavors.
Well, Thomas Barfield, since you've been going to Afghanistan for many decades now and studying the culture and the politics, what can you explain this sort of the disconnect between the apparent disconnect between the obvious sense of aspirations for governance and democracy? There's a poll from the Free and Fair Election Foundation that found 75% of Afghans say they wanted this election. And it's pretty clear from the coverage that the Afghan people, you see them lined up in this lousy weather under the threat of attacks from the Taliban. So there's no question about the aspirations for democracy, but yet what we see in that government is anything but encouraging.
Well, that's true, and one of the reasons people are out is, I don't know whether they expect to see change, but I think they hope for it, in that Karzai's been in charge for 12 years, and one of the questions is, if you get a change of leadership in a country that depends so much on personal relationships, would some of these older corrupt structures be swept aside? The real difficulty, however, is while the Afghans have elections, they lack a lot of the apparatus that you really need for democracy, including political parties. So whether it's for parliament or district level or for the presidency, all these candidates run as individuals. It's really hard to change a system when everybody is being voted for as an individual and there's no party structure in Afghanistan. Candidates do not run as representatives of a party. This makes it very difficult to actually put together a government after you win.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So on Friday, two Associated Press journalists were shot in the Khos province, sitting in the back of a car. One, of course, is an award-winning German photographer, Anja Niedringhaus, and she died, and then a Canadian reporter, Kathy Gannon, was injured. That sort of leads one to sort of question this, you know, antediluvian kind of medieval component of Afghan society, that has it been changed by this 11 years of American occupation and the billions of dollars that have been poured in? I mean, this was an act of a soldier, supposedly, on our side.
Yes, this is a most unfortunate situation, because to some extent it seems to be almost random as opposed to a targeted attack. But I would say that the impact of the United States, the international community in general, has been largest in the cities. And the two reporters are visiting one of the most conservative rural areas in Afghanistan. And to some extent, it's almost like night and day sometimes between the rural and urban areas. And this has a very long-standing division in Afghanistan, that policies that are popular in the capital are often opposed by conservatives, and particularly along the Pakistan border in various rural areas. And that's one of the dichotomies of Afghanistan, that what it looks like often depends upon where you happen to stand.
So the assumption would be that this soldier just was offended by the presence of these Western women. because
he was apparently as a police officer, but one can only presume he did immediately surrender, so he's alive. So presumably there'll be a trial, and perhaps we'll find some reason. Actually, in terms of rural Afghanistan, this is extremely shocking because these people would be considered guests, and guests are not supposed to be subject to violence. They're under the protection of the local community, and also that they're women. In Afghanistan, women are not normally considered to be targets of like blood revenge or assassination or anything else. So it'll actually shock many rural Afghans, much as the Taliban attack on the Serena Hotel, in which an Afghan journalist and his family was shot dead, tended to shock Afghans, whether they were rural or urban, because it broke many of their own cultural values that structure even things like violence, and so are considered to be quite upsetting and out of the norm.
And he was a popular journalist, and of course his wife and children were killed with him, and that is considered crossing the line. And in the other case of the women being shot in this area near the Pakistan border, they were subject to what's called Pashtunwali, right? The code of...
In which case women are not considered to be legitimate targets of warfare. I mean, that's, you know, if you want to take their own point of view and their own types of values, there's a violation there. It's not considered an honorable act by any means, or an appropriate act of war or anything else.
But clearly, this country for the longest time has been a sort of rentier state, and it's not economically sustainable. And one of the great tragedies, at least to me, Thomas Barfield, is the enormous amount of money that was poured in, and with the expectation. A friend of mine who spent a lot of time there said that when the U.S. first moved in there and had that quick victory against the Taliban, the people were thrilled to see the Taliban go, and had this real expectation that America was the miracle worker. You know, the what he had heard from various villagers was, well, the Americans have put a man on the moon. They can sure fix this place. Well, that didn't happen.
That's correct, is that if you actually look at the early years of the Bush administration, it pivoted towards Iraq, and actually it cut the development budget for Afghanistan when it went into Iraq. So Afghanistan was actually starved of resources at the beginning, and there was never any urgency about making things happen. Also, there was never really an attempt to think, well, how are you going to build Afghanistan if it's a largely agricultural economy? How do you at least start with getting that to work? So while a lot of money was spent, a lot of Afghans saw that not much really reached them. This produced a certain amount of cynicism over time, but also a tremendous amount of disappointment that a lot of money seemed to be pouring in, but to very little effect.
So, Thomas Barfield, could something have worked? I mean, when you've got a situation where the elite, including the President Karzai's own family, are sending billions, at least hundreds of millions of dollars, from very questionable, either from drugs or from USAID that's been pilfered, to Dubai, plane loads of it have been going out. So how can one have much confidence in a country when its own elite doesn't have any confidence in it?
Well, its own elite quickly realized that if you were sending money in without responsibility, why not take most of it? I think right at the beginning, before these huge amounts of money had come in, or essentially before corruption had become endemic, if you actually said, okay, we're going to build a road, and this is how much we're going to pay per mile, and we're not going to pay it till it's finished, and you get a road, you get $10,000, you know, per kilometer or something. There would have been ways to sort of work with Afghanistan to have not sort of paperwork responsibility, but actual responsibility. Are we getting value for money? And that never seemed to be a priority of the Bush administration, particularly. And as a result, a rather poor set of government officials came in and realized nobody's really keeping track of the money, and nobody's looking to see is the money actually being spent to do what it's said to being spent. And that's sort of a recipe for corruption and for cynicism. And the reports that have been coming out now about how poorly this money has been spent, if they had been coming out in 2003, 2004, and 2005, we might have been able to correct it. It's a little bit late now to say, look at all we've done, and it's either not there or not working.
Well, because the Pentagon can't even figure out its own bookkeeping about what happened to all this money in Afghanistan, you are led to assume that not only did Afghans pilfer the money, Afghan officials in particular, but it looks like Americans also pilfered the money.
Well, some of it's pilfering, but some of it is if you give a contract that has 50% in overhead, that's not considered a corruption. That's considered good accountancy. So a lot of the money that was spent in Afghanistan never reached Afghanistan. It was spent on consultants. It was spent on contracts. And, you know, to some extent, we don't consider that corruption, but many Afghans looking at it says, what's worse, you know, a contract that provides 80% overhead or a governor that steals 20%? As far as they're concerned, they want to see actually what happens on the ground. And if you actually check, money that was pledged was never delivered. Money that was delivered, each country, not just the United States, tended to want to spend it on its own people. If it was a Japanese project, you buy Toyotas. If it was an American project, you buy Chevys. There was really sort of an attempt to, you know, to see the money was spent almost to, you know, benefit the people providing the aid as opposed to the Afghans themselves.
So, Thomas Barfield, just in the last couple of minutes, we know, of course, Karzai has not signed the agreement that would ratify whatever deals that the U.S. and NATO have made in terms of what they're going to leave behind. The other candidates have said they would. But most of the speculation you hear says that there'll be some kind of resumption of a civil war, although one would think from the Pakistani side, since they have clearly been financing, sheltering, and directing, if not directing the Taliban, all the while stabbing America in the back, they apparently are having second thoughts about a Taliban government in Afghanistan, which could create a reverse sanctuary situation for the Pakistan Taliban, which, in other words, would give aid and comfort to the Pakistan Taliban and be even more of a threat to the state of Pakistan. So is that your understanding, that maybe the Pakistanis think they can somehow control the chaos, the post-American withdrawal chaos?
Well, the Pakistanis have sort of always believed that all the way back to the Soviet period. And they've usually been badly surprised that their Afghan clients tend to be not so cooperative exactly when you want them to be cooperative, that they made poor puppets and actually put Pakistan in danger. The Pakistanis told Mullah Omar to turn over Osama bin Laden. They said, if you don't turn him over, the Americans are coming, and that would be a disaster for you and for us. And Mullah Omar ignored them. That was probably the biggest policy error that Pakistan, you know, experienced, because it could not control the Taliban. The other difficulty is it's not really clear. This will be the fourth foreign withdrawal from Afghanistan. Insurgents are very good about getting rid of foreigners in their country because they have a home to go home to and they want to go home. But they found it actually very difficult to overthrow Kabul governments that retain the support of international backers. The Soviets pulled out and they gave Najibullah only 6 months. They certainly thought the Mujahideen would overthrow him. He outlasted the Soviet Union. It turns out that that insurgencies are good at some things but not at others, and certainly the Najibullah government was much more unpopular than this government is. That's one of the reasons that people are concerned about signing the agreement with the Americans, not the number of troops, but they know if there's no foreign troops in the country, there'll be no foreign money coming in. They can probably survive with few or no troops. They can't survive without outside aid. So there's a very strong concern there in terms of stability. And the Afghans worried that their last civil war resulted because no international power was interested in what went on in Afghanistan. And that's a very sore memory in Afghanistan about what happens if the international community decides to turn its back on the country.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and get an assessment of the success of the Affordable Care Act sign-up of 7.1 million Americans.
اون دو چشمان مسته سیاهت مبند نازنی نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند
So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gerald Kaminsky, a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, whose current research focuses on evaluating the impacts of healthcare reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Kaminsky.
Thank you, Ian.
And what is your sense then of the celebration that took place at the White House of signing up 7.1 million people to Obamacare? The polls in this country consistently show Americans disapprove of Obamacare, and there's a sort of disconnect in terms of their ability of the Democrats to fire up voters in their effort to fend off what's considered by a lot of pollsters a likely Republican takeover of the Senate.
So let's separate the politics from sort of the objective hard facts for a minute and say that I think that certainly the White House had every reason to celebrate the 7 million figure because it really is quite astounding. Given where we were in October, a really flawed rollout of the program and what looked like a disaster at the time, playing right into the hands of the opponents of the law, saying, look, here we told you that this can't work, and in fact, the administration is proving with this flawed rollout that this law can't possibly work the way that anybody said. Here we are 6 months later with 7 million people enrolled through a process that, you know, certainly took a while to get fixed. But I think the numbers are outstanding. They exceed what our original expectations were given the flawed rollout. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office scaled back its estimates for the first year enrollment to about 6 million, and now it looks like that wasn't necessary. We got to 7 million anyway. I think California has been even more successful in terms of exceeding its targets, and so I think there's a lot of good news here with regard to the enrollment figures.
So, General Kaminsky, given that there are 350 million people in this country, 7.1 million doesn't sound like a lot. So put that in context, if you will.
Sure. So I think the total population now is roughly about 308 million.
Oh, sorry, 308, yeah.
So roughly one-sixth of Americans, roughly 50 million prior to the Affordable Care Act, were uninsured at some point during the course of the year. And that number, both in terms of percentages and absolute numbers, is as high as it's been historically. The only time that it's been higher as a percentage of the population was just prior to the enactment of the Medicare and Medicaid programs back in 1965, when roughly a quarter of all Americans, one-fourth, were uninsured. You know, those programs were very successful in reducing the number of uninsured and the percentage of uninsured Americans, but we've been drifting back up over the last few decades and reaching what are historically, again, high proportions over the past few decades. I think that the law was never intended to focus on all Americans. The Affordable Care Act is really, I think the best way to describe it is, given the system of, or the quilt, I should say, of health care financing and health insurance that we have, where the majority of Americans get their health insurance to their place of employment, and then people who don't have employment-based insurance either qualify for the Medicare program, the Medicaid program,
or if they don't qualify for any of the above, they end up in the private insurance or individual insurance market, buying insurance on their own, and that's the market that was really not functioning very well. It worked for some people, but it did not work for millions of other Americans who could not afford the policies. That was an insurance market where insurers had the right to deny coverage based on your pre-existing conditions, or if not to outright deny coverage, to charge you a much higher premium and therefore make the insurance unaffordable to you because of your health history. And as a result, millions of Americans would go into that individual marketplace and not be able to find an affordable policy. So the Affordable Care Act really attempted to do two things. One was to reform the individual market to make insurance more affordable in that marketplace for people who don't get insurance through their place of employment, and then to expand the Medicaid program, which is a joint federal and state program nationally, to expand those programs to cover everyone who had income up to 138% of the poverty level. And between those two reforms or expansions, the goal was to reduce the number of uninsured from about 50 million to down to about 15 to 18 million Americans. And so the law was really never intended to affect the vast majority of Americans, but it was really targeted at the people who were still falling through the cracks.
So then the question arises, Gerald Kaminsky, whether those people who are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act are going to vote. I mean, and whether, as some say, that the real challenge will be to keep costs under control so that insurance premiums don't go up in the next years for the more middle class and wealthier Americans who might vote against it. I mean, it seems like as we go into this election year, as in terms of Obamacare, which, as you know, the House has tried, I think something like 42 times to repeal. The Republicans seem to me, at least, to be curiously silent at this point. The Democrats are clearly ambivalent, and it seems like the Democratic strategy is to say, you know, that Obamacare's, you know, admit that Obamacare has flaws, but say, you know, we're going to fix them. So that seems to be how they're going to approach the narrative.
Yeah, so now, sort of switching to the politics, so the program's been successful in terms of enrolling millions of people, and we won't know, one key question that's we don't know the answer to yet and won't know until later this year when some of the surveys or national survey data are in, is how many of the people who signed up for benefits are newly insured. In other words, we know that people who had insurance last year and bought insurance on their own without subsidies are now buying insurance this year with subsidies that are newly available through the ACA. So that's a good thing for those people. It's made insurance more affordable for them, but it doesn't reduce the number of uninsured. But based on work that we've done in California and estimates that we've developed for the state and for Covered California, we think that around 57% of the people who are newly signed up in Covered California were previously uninsured. And if those numbers hold true nationally, that means of the 7 million who signed up through the exchanges nationwide, roughly 4 million would be newly insured and previously uninsured. And I think that that's an enormous number, and it's a great first-year success. In terms of the politics, though, it's clear that Republicans want to tap into dissatisfaction with the law to regain control, to solidify their gains in the House and to regain control of the Senate. And, you know, there are indications that they may be successful in doing that. The overall dissatisfaction with the law continues to be relatively high. It's clearly split along party lines. Republicans are continue to be strongly against the law. Independents mixed, and Democrats, although strongly in favor, that strong support has been diminishing over the last few years, and it's it's not surprising. There's been 4 years of attacks against the law before the really major benefits went into effect. So once again, we're entering an election season where we're going to have yet another referendum on is this law a good thing or not. And I do think that Republicans, although they're strangely silent right now, are crafting a message that will tap into sort of ongoing sentiment that expansion of government, regardless of whether it benefits millions of people, is not a good thing. And there are millions of voters around the country who are against any expansion of government programs, regardless of who they benefit. Republicans will also be able to tap into dissatisfaction among people who lost their insurance because of the ACA and had to buy new policies that were perhaps more expensive than the ones they had before. One of the reforms of the market was standardization of insurance policies, and frankly, people benefited, especially people who were generally healthy and did not have pre-existing conditions, could buy inexpensive policies previously that are no longer available today. And that voter dissatisfaction, although, again, I think that the numbers I've seen indicate that that's a relatively small number of people nationally, that will be blown completely out of proportion, and the impression will be that hundreds of millions of Americans have suffered that, as opposed to the actual numbers, which are probably closer to 2 or 3 million.
Again, I'm speaking with Gerald Kaminsky, Professor of Health Policy and Management and Director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, whose current research focuses on evaluating the impacts of health care reform. Well, it's pretty clear that in these key Senate races, the Democrats, either challengers or incumbents, are running away from Obamacare. In Kentucky, where they've had a very successful sign-up, nevertheless, the Democratic nominee, Alison Grimes, is running away from it, as is Senator Mark Begich in Alaska, Kay Hagan in North Carolina, and Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. So what's your sense then? Just again, my sense is that the people who are going to benefit from this are, you know, the poor. They don't tend to vote. And the people who may be hurt by it are the middle class, and they tend to vote. Is that too facile an analysis?
No, it's not. I mean, I think that it's generally true. You know, the benefits of this program are largely subsidies are available for people up to 400% of the federal poverty level. For a family of four, that's around $94,000. So that's, you know, not poor, but it's middle class. But the benefits extend all the way down to the Medicaid program for people at 138% of federal poverty level and below. And for a family of four, that's around roughly $32,000 or so, or $28,000. So, yes, the program, the ACA largely benefits low and middle-income families, and it hurts some other middle and upper income families who previously had really inexpensive insurance because the market was screened for bad risk. If you keep all the bad risk on the sideline, you can keep insurance premiums very affordable for healthy people. So there'll be some dissatisfaction among people who lost that privilege or that advantage of being in a pre-screened market that only healthy people could get insurance and therefore keep the cost artificially low. It is, unfortunately, a sign of the times that issues regarding poverty and programs to reduce poverty in the United States are not resonating with Democrats, and generally do not resonate with Republicans anyway. And so the people who are benefiting from the program are less likely to vote, are not going to be protesting. They don't have a well-funded organization like Americans for Prosperity out there singing the praises of the law. And as a result, despite the fact that millions are benefiting, we're getting lost in the politics of this, and instead focusing on the problems with the rollout, the problems with the website, the fact that this is an expansion of government and that therefore is bad per se, regardless of whether people are benefiting or not. And that message, again, resonates with people who are more conservative and are opponents of the law.
Well, the president, in his remarks in the Rose Garden on April the 1st, celebrating the 7.1 million sign-ups, was guilty of a little hyperbole, saying billions of dollars of worth of commercials have been opposing the law. The real figure apparently is about $500 million, but it does look as though both the White House and the Democrats are going to use the Koch brothers as kind of poster boys for being opposed to the Affordable Care Act, and I'm just wondering whether this strategy of admitting Obamacare's flaws at the same time saying that they're going to fix it all, and so in other words, this, it may not be the best thing in the world, but we're going to fix it. And by the way, the Koch brothers are the reason why. If they're opposing it, then it's got to be a good thing.
Well, it's a good thing for a whole variety of reasons, and I think that, you know, we can sort of debate. I'm not privy to sort of, you know, what's internal discussions that are going on in the White House in terms of strategy. I must admit, however, as someone who is a close observer of this now for the last 5 years, including, you know, as the legislation was being developed and discussed in the 2008 campaign, that I am perplexed at times that the messaging regarding, you know, expanding health insurance coverage seems to be so complex and so difficult to explain. I do think that the messaging could be more consistent. And one lesson that's very clear from the last few years is that it continues to be intense opposition, and therefore it's necessary to continue to have sort of intensive selling of why this is a good piece of legislation. And why millions of Americans are benefiting from it, and millions of Californians. So, you know, if I had an opportunity to speak directly to the president about this, I think I would encourage him to be on the offensive and to continue to fight to sell the bill, to sell the law and the advantages of the law, rather than to be in a defensive position. Regarding what I think is really a significant achievement.
Well, General Kaminsky, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with General Kaminsky, who's a professor of health policy and management and director of the UCLA Center for Health Policy Research, whose current research focuses on evaluating the impacts of healthcare reform. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with one of the authors of a new book, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my...
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Herschel, who's director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. His latest book, just out, is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Herschel.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And you, along with your co-authors, have been working on this for some time. That's Mark Rank and Herbert Hadley. I take it that you worked through the panel for the panel study of income dynamics, which is the longest running longitudinal household survey in the world. So you've gathered, what, 41 years worth of data?
That's correct. That's correct. We have 41 years worth of data, and we've been looking at these data for about 20 years because they give us a unique perspective on American society, where I think we tend to discuss with our friends and our colleagues maybe the positive side of our lives. And we started noticing when we were analyzing these data that people go through a lot of adverse economic events. And in fact, 80% of the country has some economic adverse event, either unemployment, poverty, or using the safety net, at least once between the age of 25 and 60. And about 40% of those people will have it five or more economic adverse events. So we began to see this pattern of we actually have a very economically vulnerable society. And probably most importantly, the vulnerability is increasing over time.
So then how do you relate this to the fact that the rich are getting richer? I mean, is that at the heart of this argument over income equality?
What's happening is that the top 10% are getting greater and greater shares of total income, therefore greater and greater shares of accumulated wealth in terms of assets. And so I think it even spills over into political situations where, you know, what the decisions the government makes, strategic decisions about how the economy works, that becomes more under the influence of the wealthy, who then can use money to influence politics. And the average person is with less and less money. So over time, this begins, I think, even to erode our democracy.
So in terms of the panel study on income dynamics, which began at the University of Michigan in 1968, and you have a representative sample of over 18,000 individuals living in 5,000 families.
That's right.
And the information was collected continuously through 1996 and every year after that. And this data covers employment, income, wealth, expenditures, health, marriage, childbearing, child development, philanthropy, education, and numerous other topics. So there's no question, to my mind, Thomas Herschel, that you and your co-authors have done your homework.
Yeah, we worked hard on the data. The data go through 2009, from 1968 until 2009. And we're actually continuing to work on the data. And even after the book is published, we're still writing more papers. And probably we're going to have a second book because there's so much to say about what's happening right now. But we think we have a representative sample. And what we really find is that people can actually have, you know, they can have events in their life which are represent prosperity. They might make a six-figure income for a couple of years, and then maybe a decade later they hit a hard spot and they go into poverty. And in fact, we interviewed, besides the data, we also interviewed 70 people, and we conducted 18 focus groups as well to try to get a sense of how people understood their experiences. And when we really started probing people, we found that, yes, those experiences are there. You just kind of have to sort of scratch the surface, and people start talking about the issues. You know, their husband fell off a roof, or they had a medical problem that was very devastating financially. And that really the country is very vulnerable, and that's not really part of the political discourse. Obama started talking about it, I guess, somewhat recently. There's this myth that we historically have been a middle-class society. And our book kind of goes through that people understand this idea that if they work hard and they play by the rules, they'll get ahead. And that's kind of the dominant thinking of the American people. That's starting to change a little bit, but our book shows that that's still very widespread, that people work hard to try to, you know, do well, and they're diligent, and they expect to do well, and when they don't, they get really upset, which is understandable.
And I guess the real political question is, how does that upset manifest itself? It does seem that Republicans are very good at getting people who are angry to vote, in effect, against their own interest. Rather than blame the plutocrats, they blame the government.
Yes. I mean, I think people this is something new, especially for white America, to have these kinds of adverse events. And I think the Republicans are trying to play a populist card, and the Democrats are also maybe doing something somewhat similar. But you have something, you have little inklings of changes in the country. For example, there's a movement that started in North Carolina called Moral Monday, where people started going down to the courthouse, especially at the state capitol in Raleigh, and protesting the fact that the state is opting out of Medicaid, the extension of Medicaid. They're opting out of long-term unemployment benefits, and that it's very difficult to survive for many families in North Carolina. And they're doing civil disobedience, and already over 1,000 people have been arrested in North Carolina, and it's actually spreading to other southern states. But that sort of thing is representing a new kind of consciousness that's sort of beyond what our book is able to identify in the main aspects of the opinion surveys that we looked at.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. His latest book just out is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. And this book finds that a majority of Americans, you say up to 80%, will experience poverty despite the American's dream's promise of a good life that is attainable through hard work and perseverance. So, to my mind, Thomas Herschel, then, this is really a question of what do we do with the information that our reality is at odds with the myth of the American dream and the Horatio Alger idea that through hard work and perseverance, you just pull up your bootstraps and you'll make it. And if as it appears to be the case, the system is rigged, I mean, there's nothing more graphic in terms of making that point, at least to my mind, than the one of the heirs to the DuPont fortune, who's sexually molested his own 3-year-old daughter and 18-month-year-old son, gets off, pays a $5,000 fine, and the judge says, suspends his sentence to home, detention. Because of jails would not be good for him, you know?
I mean, jails are not good for the people in jail, that's for sure.
Right, but in other words, because he's rich and privileged, then a jail would be bad for him, so therefore we can't punish him for sexually molesting his own 3-year-old daughter.
Wow, I didn't hear about that, Ian. That's shocking. You know, I think that's kind of where we're headed, is this kind of like, a privileged section of society that's not subject to the same rules as the majority. I mean, the majority of the population is at risk of poverty. And I think that people can deal with this. We can't. The wealth is, the country has the wealth to eliminate poverty. The thing is that we don't really have public discourse that would lead to those posing the question in a way that we could begin to solve those problems. I mean, there's kind of an interesting situation. In New York State, there's a community that lives up in the Adirondacks, which has very severe winters, and they have kind of a social security system that the community has built because they understand that they have to take care of themselves just to make it through the winter. So they have a place, it's called a food pantry, but actually they can get blankets and all kinds of supplies that if someone has a problem, if their house burns down or something, they can go to this community facility and just take the things they need. There's no means testing. It's just done by community consensus. So that's kind of, and I've been studying that community for a number of years now in the Adirondacks. And that kind of thing, the people who live there understand that if they acted as individuals, they would be at risk of death because it's a very sparsely populated area. And if you run out of food, you die very quickly in the cold winter. And so people kind of check up on each other if they don't show up for work or if they don't leave their house at the normal time. And that kind of thinking, I think, is really not part of our middle class way of life, that we need to start taking care of each other.
Well, that would be, I think, where the division is, isn't it? There, it would seem to me that the Republicans, their strategy is to divide, and particularly along race and gender lines, to keep alive issues of homosexuality, etc., and opposition to it, and keep alive issues of race, even though in many ways the upcoming millennial generation have gotten over both of those ideas that these things are a problem. And it would seem to me that, you know, on the one hand, you've got a party that knows how to divide. On the other hand, you've got a party, the Democrats, who don't know how to unite.
Right. I think that's well put, Ian. I think you put that really well. I think that's correct, that American politics from the beginning, especially, were about racial division, coming out of the legacy of, I mean, slavery has been over with for a long time, but the politics of racial division are still very strong in the South. So you have a lot of congressional districts and municipalities that are gerrymandered on the basis of race, and that then spills over into sexuality and gender and all kinds of other things, where people are divided against each other instead of trying to understand their needs as part of a community. They see themselves as part of a group or as an individual, or just straight individualism, I think, is also a very strong belief that we have in American society. So, you know, I think what's really called for is some new kind of thinking, and we can solve these problems. It's not like this is not rocket science. There's plenty of wealth, there's plenty of technology to take care of the things that we need and to meet our needs, but that can only happen if we pose questions about the collective need.
Well, our previous guest who was giving us an analysis of the Affordable Care Act, where, you know, the White House is celebrating having 7.1 million people sign up. And what I got out of the discussion was that, you know, the irony that the people who've mostly benefited from the Affordable Care Act so far are people who have not had insurance before, who haven't been able to get it before, and they tend to be poorer, and they may not vote. They, you know, there may not be a payoff. You know, Obama's done the right thing, but there's this expression in America, "Nice guys finish last." You know that he's done the right thing. He's brought at least half of 7.1 million people out, providing them with something that they've desperately needed for decades, if not centuries, and yet the Republicans are running on the idea of a middle class backlash against this terrible government intrusion into your lives, and there's some evidence that maybe premiums might go up for the middle class. So it seems to me that's a test case in many ways of what is so strange is that we have a kind of hostility to the poor, I guess.
Yes, I think that's correct. We have a kind of a bias against the poor, that it's a stigmatized. If you're poor, it's because it's a fault of your own. The people in North Carolina that are in the Moral Monday movement, they really are working very hard to make sure that people are registered, and they have the added impediment that they have to have a state-approved ID to vote in North Carolina now. They have a voting document law. So I think people are getting aware of this, that voting is a very important part of the, or it's one part of the political process of enfranchisement.
Well, there's also a deep feeling out there, though, which certainly around this Pacifica radio network, most of the coverage and political messaging, I would say, if any, is a plague on both their houses. The Democrats and the Republicans, there's no difference between the two of them. Either don't vote or vote for meaningless marginal parties like the Greens and the Peace and Freedom. So, you know, there is and it's in many ways justified, a kind of disgust at the two-party system.
Yeah, I think there is. I think that for one thing, the Republican Party is somewhat shorn of its base because the small businesses, this community is having a very hard time staying afloat in this climate where only the most powerful businesses are really succeeding, the biggest corporations. And the labor unions have really, you know, they're less than 10% of the private workforce are in unions now, which was a key link to the... So I think civil society is really not well connected to either of the parties right now, and they're tending to work on money, just, you know, the money of the wealthy are driving a lot of the problems,
right, which in case people haven't been following the Supreme Court, they just opened the floodgates even further.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we know what direction the law is heading in, and the empowerment and added privilege to the plutocracy, as though they were somehow a beleaguered minority who couldn't express themselves on a level playing field. I mean, the whole logic of that is so monstrously distorted; it's mind-boggling.
Right. Right. It kind of fits in with the logic of what's happening economically when you think about the wealth is pyramiding upward, the income is pyramiding upward, and then those are the people that have the most influence over the politics. So then the law is actually changing to facilitate that process. But I think we'll also begin to see sort of a mobilization from below where people understand they have to. You have a group like the Move to Amend, which is trying to amend the Constitution to take money out of politics. So the reverse is also beginning to happen now, and I think that's really important that people are developing these new understandings that we need not just to get new candidates, but we need to reform the whole political process.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Herschel, some months back, the Associated Press ran a story based upon the research that you and your co-authors have done, that was a preview of this new book that you've done, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. And it was a real shock and a wake-up to most Americans that up to 80% of Americans at some point in their lives experience poverty, and that in the land of opportunity, there's a real dark side and a growing recognition that the playing field is not level and you can't make it just through hard work and perseverance, and that the game is rigged against you. So what are you hoping is the takeaway for people who get your book, which presumably they should?
Well, we hope our book really has a lot of hopeful stories in it, because we interview people who are really serious about having an optimistic view, being not just optimistic about their own lives, but being optimistic in terms of their loved ones, their families, you know, providing a foundation, a better future for their children. And we think, you know, the American people are very energetic and optimistic, but at the same time, we need to kind of shift gears. Our kind of editorializing on the data at the end is kind of like, well, we need new ideas, new organizations to really achieve the American dream for more and more people, for everyone. I mean, there's this rhetoric of our culture, freedom for all and the Pledge of Allegiance, justice for all. Well, it's never really been justice for all or freedom for all. It's always been restricted to sometimes by gender, almost always by race. But we can begin to have those things if we start to look more broadly. And we believe that really by looking at ourselves and seeing who we are and what we can achieve, if we can develop new ideas and new organizations, we can get there. So we feel like even though the country is kind of heading in the wrong direction, the answers are implicit in the reasons for that.
So in other words, it shouldn't only be the rich who can pursue happiness.
Yeah, everybody. That's right. We have a technology now. We have computers and biotech and mm-hmm. ways of producing things that are marvelous, and we just need to kind of get them to work in the public interest.
Well, Thomas Herschel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. His latest book just out is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more light goes out in the